Are you ready for an open discussion with the best of the best and the best of what's next? Welcome to the Tony D'Urso Show with Tony D'Urso. Tony will have a conversation today with one of the world's great influencers as they showcase the newest, hottest, and best trends from all walks of life. Now, here's Tony D'Urso.
Welcome, and thanks for joining in with us. You know, after 3 decades in corporate America and 3 decades of being an entrepreneur, I can tell you that the message you give to your public, your business associates, your employees, your clients, and so forth, is probably more important than you may think of at first. And I want to tell you, I've seen a lot of what I consider bad messages, wrong information, maybe some misinformation, a lot of stuff that has no business really being spread to the world. And yet it not only spreads, but it takes root like a seed in fertile soil, and it grows and grows. Why is this? Well, a clear and simple message is king. That's why. Do you want to succeed in your business? Of course you do. And to succeed, you need to better understand not only what does it mean to have a clear and simple message, but the masterpiece is on how to design them. We're going to talk about how to design winning messages with Ben Gutman, and we're going to teach you how to communicate with clarity. And while we're at it, this is all about helping you and your friends move on your journey to success. We want to help you get very successful, and we're going to help turn you into an elite entrepreneur. Well, meet Ben Gutman. He's a former co-founder and partner at Digital Natives Group. It's an award-winning agency, and he's worked with the NFL, Comcast, NBC Universal, and other big-name clients. And he's currently a digital marketing teacher at Baruch College in New York. I said that right. I think that says enough. Let's get into it. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the Tony D'Urso Show.
Nice to be here, Tony. Thanks for having me.
The honor is mine. You know, we're all looking forward to learning how to design winning messages. And what I like to do is, how did it all start for you, Ben? What's your backstory? Let's take it there.
So you mentioned Baruch College, where I now teach as an adjunct professor, but I went to Baruch College also. I'm a graduate of the City University of New York. And when I was a student there, I was a big dork. I was a big student government dork, and I was president my senior year. And I was so focused on doing that that I didn't do all of the like internship stuff that you're supposed to do when you're a college senior, when you're going to graduate. Fortunately, though, I had a professor who ran a marketing agency just outside of the city, and he pulled me aside one day and said, hey, I know you kind of want to start your own thing. We need some help with digital. Maybe we can figure something out. And one thing leads to another. We pile in my 94 Honda Accord. We drive out of the city, slap our logo on the wall of their basement, and open up shop as Digital Natives Group. And so we were there for about a year. Honestly, we were too much of, you know, the 21-year-old knuckleheads to really know what we were doing with like their Fortune 500 clients and stuff. But we cut our teeth with the local ice cream shop, the local camera shop, those type of businesses. And one thing leads to another. We end up getting an office back in the city in Queens in LIC. We hire our first employees. We get a bigger office. We hire more employees. And 10 years later, we have a portfolio that includes, as you mentioned, like the NFL and I Love New York and Grand Central Terminal, all these really wonderful clients. And it was a really exciting ride. We had a great time. But 10 years in, you know, we were kind of at this turning point here. And we said, well, you know, to get to the next level, it makes sense to kind of sell the business as it is now, find a home for all those clients and all those employees. And we were very fortunate about, you know, the opportunity that we had to do that. And since then, I've been doing a lot of other stuff. So I've gone back and I teach at Baruch College, doing that for a number of years. I wrote my first book, which we're talking about today a little bit. So simply put, why clear messages win and how to design them is in many ways kind of the culmination of a lot of the stuff that I learned in the field. You know, being a marketer for small, medium, and large size companies for years and years, as well as what I've seen in the classroom, what I've seen in the science, and also what I see as kind of a user of the world, right? As a customer, as a voter, as a donor, as all these different things, I see the same challenge everywhere I look, which is that people have something that's really great that they want to share, that they have a great story they want to tell, a great product they want to get out there, a cause they want to move. And they just have a hard time connecting, right? And this happens, in the classroom, it happens in the boardroom. And so that's what I was looking to solve as part of this book. And I think I had a really exciting time kind of diving into that question and identifying some of the ways which we can all get better at that.
You know, I love what's in your book and where you go, and we're going to pick that up in just a moment. But what I'm seeing here is, well, first of all, you're very astute in spotting, as I mentioned in the introduction, you know, why is it so important to have a clean, clear message? And you know, we're going to go into that as well. But what I'm seeing here is you're really good at it, but you're not just, I don't mean it that way, not just good. You're so good, and you've gone from that into teaching people how to communicate. So it's two different things. One is doing it. The other is now you've decided to teach people. So I'm curious, where did the vision come that you're saying, hey, I'm so good at this, so many people need help, let me help them and let me do it. Tell us about how that became a business for you.
Yeah, I mean, the teaching part of it was large because I wanted to get back in the classroom and kind of give back in that capacity, right? I gained so much from the experience that I had when I was a student at this wonderful institution that I wanted to make sure I was able to kind of pay it forward in that sense. That's how I initially kind of got into the classroom, was wanted to take what I learned from the school, but also from the field, and then kind of pay it forward. But as I've been doing, I've done 20 semesters now of teaching there, which has been incredible. As I've been doing it, I've learned a lot more about, well, what is it that resonates? How do we have to talk about these things in a way that kind of gets across? I've become a better communicator because of it. I've had the fortune of having kind of a classroom full of guinea pigs basically every semester to be able to learn from them and to run different case studies and focus groups and experiments. And so that's been an absolute joy as well. I call teaching my favorite hobby, right? I do it kind of, you know, one day a week basically is what I do for the teaching. And I will wholeheartedly recommend, if anybody is ever thinking about doing it, thinking about getting back in the classroom at the, you know, kind of high school level, at the junior college or community college level, or the senior college or PhD, whatever it is, go try it. I recommend it. It's very, it's the stuff that fills you up, right, in life. It's not the junk food. It's the stuff that really makes a difference. They'll have to pull me out of the classroom, you know, to get me ever out of there.
Sounds to me like you found your purpose. Let's expand more on that. Like, why do you do it? I mean, I get that you're helping other people and you're also learning as well, but it seems like you have such a drive to do it. So I'd like to just kind of drill down into why.
Yeah. I mean, so I mentioned the paying it forward piece. That's a huge component of it. Baruch is a unique institution. So it is part of the City University of New York, also known as CUNY. CUNY is one of the largest public institutions in the country. There's 500,000 or so, I might get the number wrong, students across the city, across all the different campuses. It's the largest engine of economic opportunity in kind of almost the world, right? It's incredible what that institution is able to do in terms of increasing household incomes, providing pathways out of poverty, providing opportunity for first generation immigrants. There's incredible stuff that CUNY is able to do. I'm the child of two CUNY graduates, also at Queens College. So I'm a huge advocate of the mission of the organization, this massive organization, multi-billion-dollar organization, huge advocate of their mission. So that's one piece of it. And the other piece is I'm also a big believer that if you want to learn something, teaching is one of the best ways to do it. And teaching can be in the form of being in a classroom. It could be in the form of writing a book. It could be the form of just talking in a podcast or writing articles. That's how you really understand stuff. When I was doing it at the beginning, I was still very young and I was still trying to figure out what I was, you know, I was kind of faking it till I make it a little bit in the first couple semesters there. But as things go and you really start to hone things in, you say, okay, well, now I really understand, you know, I really understand this stuff because I've been forced to get somebody else to really understand it. And so that's something I recommend. And also, I just have a plain old good time doing it, right? You get in front of the class, and you know, they, it's a cliche, but like they keep you young, you know, all this other stuff. But do I ever want to do it full time? Probably not, to be honest. I enjoy it as a hobby or as a component of what I do, but it is certainly something that that I've really, really benefited from in many ways.
Sounds like a lot of fun. It brings me back to my days in the college and university, and just the fun of studying and learning. Even though you may know some things, then there's another level where you know it better, or you know it from other angles. So it's a fulfilling environment. It's very rewarding. For me, I found it very rewarding when I went to university and so forth. So I can, not that I've taught that way, though I've taught other ways, but I can kind of get the additional level of what is it, that not that excitement, but that passion to help others and to teach them. So I like that. We're talking about how to design winning messages, and we've got some good stuff coming up on that. We're speaking with Ben Gutman, and you're going to find him at bengutman.com. I'll spell that. It's BenGutTTMann.com. If you're German, I'm Italian, but if you're German, it's Gutman, which I believe means good man, Ben Gutman, but it's really Gutman. But I just wanted to mention that. I think that that's where that comes from.
My grandfather is Czechoslovakian, or actually originally from what was then Hungary before the war. And so, yes, it does mean good man. I appreciate you spelling it, because I always joke, it's not a great name for radio, right? You know, it has two T's and two N's. You got to remember both of them.
We'll probably spell it again later. Now, if you've been following my show, you may know that some time ago that Yahoo News featured my podcast early on in my career. And I've always been grateful to them, and I've always been favorable to Yahoo. And as you know, that when you really like something, that you attract it, I'm pleased to announce that Yahoo Finance has offered to sponsor a few episodes. It's quite an honor. Now, as I speak with millionaires and billionaires often on my show, and entrepreneurs at the top of their category, I call them all elite entrepreneurs, I find it really helpful to be in touch with what's going on in the world. I mean, that's a no-brainer, isn't it? And I've been looking at Yahoo Finance quite a bit. And I got to tell you, I'm hooked on the news briefs. I just love the summaries. I get what I want real quick. You know, I don't have all day to read every article possible, and neither do you. And I love the section called Market Domination. First of all, the music is invigorating. And what I wind up doing is I keep the browser open a lot so that I can catch what I can when I can. And I just keep it there while I'm doing everything, and I just peek in. I find that it has parallels to my shows, where you really get behind the scenes sort of what's going on and how this person is dealing with that or not. Like right now, this moment, I'm watching Edward Norton on why and how he invests and the companies that he's behind. That's fascinating information. You get some really good intel on this Yahoo Finance program. I think it's a must watch, especially if you like the kind of material and superstars that I have on my show. And of course, at a glance, I see in real time stocks and metals that I keep track of, like Apple, Tesla, gold, silver, and others. I'm watching quite a few, and I really love the way that it just shows so easily right there on that browser whenever I want. It's very cool. There's a lot at a glance, and I'm falling in love with it. So I ask you, check out yahoofinance.com and tell me what you like best about it. And just a quick thank you, that I really appreciate you listening to my weekly shows with today's elite entrepreneurs. If you like the show, would you please go to Apple Podcasts and give a cool review? Look up the Tony D'Urso Show and drop a kind one. And now I have an important insider's brief for you. So let's go to that next, and then I'll circle back to Ben. And here's an insider's brief about high-tech home improvements for spring. Now, at this moment, most of us have our heating and cooling systems shut off. I know I do. So this makes for a great time for home improvement projects, doesn't it? I've been planting the past couple weeks and just enjoying the nice, cool weather. And what I want to touch upon today is just a little bit of, we're going to talk about our outdoor space. We're going to talk about saving energy, and we're going to talk about fire safety. Let's say three very important items or topics to go over. And with us is Tom Kreitler. He's a home improvement specialist and the co-host of the Money Pit radio program. And he's been in this industry for quite a few decades, so he knows a few things. Let's bring him on. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Tony, thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here with you today.
The honor is mine. And you know, many of us were not bombarded with rain and bad weather at the moment, so we have a chance to work on some projects, and I want to talk about some of them. But first, my interest has piqued, and I hope some of my audience. Could you tell us a little bit about your home improvement radio program so we understand a little bit more about you?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I have a kind of a strange career. I started as I went to college to be a shop teacher. Remember those days when we had wood shop, metal shop, and all of that? And I did that as my career for a couple of years. And then I was in the construction industry after that as a general contractor. And as a general contractor, I sort of morphed into the home inspection business. And I tell you this because as a home inspector, I spent 20 years going through people's houses, figuring out how they're put together and most importantly, how they fall apart. And I used to get asked to do interviews on radio shows every once in a while to sort of ask the expert kinds of stuff, you know, why is my floor squeak? Why is my toilet leak? That sort of thing. And that actually morphed into a whole new career as a radio host and starting the Money Pit Home Improvement Radio Show back in the late 90s. So we've been at it now over 20 years. We air on 465 stations around the country every single weekend. And it's fun. I love to talk to people that are working on their homes and give them some tips and advice and ideas and help them deal with issues they're trying to resolve. They don't know where to start. And, you know, usually it's stuff that we've heard before and seen before and can get them back on the road to positive home improvement results.
Oh, good. Well, this is perfect because as I was just mentioning, this is the best time of the year, I think, to really get into some projects. No more being lazy. We've got the time and the opportunity to do some stuff. So let's start here. How about making our outdoor space a little bit more usable and livable?
Yeah. So, you know, it's tough to find outdoor spaces sometimes, and they're the most popular area to renovate. But if you're looking for space and can't find it, and you happen to have an elevated deck, I will tell you that the area under the deck is entirely finishable. Now, typically, it's damp, it's dingy, it's got moss growing around it. But if you add an underdeck drainage system, that area can be used for almost anything. So Trex Rain Escape is one of those systems. It's a network of troughs and downspouts that diverts water away from the deck, and that protects the structure from rot and decay. Now it installs right below the joist. Most of the drainage systems, I should say, install below the joist of the deck, but Rain Escape installs over top, and that protects the entire structure and also allows homeowners to run gas and electrical lines just below the deck surface. And this way, you could power lighting down there, appliances, you know, paddle fan, whatever you want to put. And the truth is that when you do this, you've now doubled your deck's living space. And it's an easy install. All it takes is a utility knife, staple gun, and a caulk gun. And you can install it on a brand new deck or on one where you're replacing the deck boards. It's a really nice improvement to make for those spaces.
Very, very good point. And the one thing you mentioned is about the drainage. We just did that. Our downspouts on the side of the building here were all going directly against the side of the building in the ground. And we just literally a couple of weeks ago had them all, had the end parts fitted to take the water away from the building so that it wouldn't, you know, rot out or mess with the foundation. So that's a very important point.
That is so very important, and I can't tell you how many of my listeners have learned that the hard way, and many have actually hired best basement waterproofing contractors who shamelessly will tell them that their very expensive $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 drainage system is the only way to stop basements and crawl spaces from leaking, when all it takes is clean gutters and downspouts extended away from the building.
Absolutely, and you know, it was only a couple bucks. It was not expensive whatsoever.
Exactly.
So we got that out of the way. Now, outdoor, we usually don't use a lot of electricity, though sometimes we do depending on lighting, but we also have low voltage lighting. But the reason I want to bring up electricity is I know you're a specialist in this, Tom, and no matter what we seem to do, at least it's in my case, my electric bill goes up and I seem to use less and less and less.
Yeah.
So I'd like to ask you if you have any tips on reducing our electrical bill. But, you know, we're on a budget, so we don't want to buy a lot of equipment. What can you help us with?
Well, you know, it's a good time to think about the appliances in your home that are using the most electricity because the technology is getting better and better. For example, if you have an electric water heater, clearly one of the most expensive appliances in the house to run. Rheem just developed a new technology in water heaters that delivers four times the efficiency of what you used to get with an electric water heater. It's called a Performance Platinum Hybrid Electric Heat Pump Water Heater. So heat pump water heaters combine the technology of heat pumps and resistance heat. That's why it's called a hybrid. And together, they can save you about $315 a year in energy cost savings. So it really dramatically takes the cost of an electric water heater way, way, way down. It's available at Home Depot, and because it's a hybrid, it can function as a standard electric water heater it can function as a heat pump water heater. So you have total control of that. It even has a web-based app that allows you to schedule that. And because it's so efficient, it also qualifies for federal tax credits. So when you look at the improvement in technology coupled with the incentives, both state and local and federal, it's a really good time to look at those really big consuming electricity, electrical appliances. Same goes for air conditioners. You know, they're getting far more efficient as well.
I like that. Can you give us the name again so next time we go to Home Depot, we can look it up?
Yeah. It's Rheem Performance Platinum Hybrid Electric Heat Pump Water Heater. You can just go to rheem.com/save. There's an easy URL. Rheem is rheem.com/save.
I like that. That's a good tip. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate that. And one other thing, I think now, especially that the rainy season is kind of out of the way and the warmer weather is coming, historically, we have to prepare for fires and make sure that, you know, we don't have dry grass sitting in piles and all sorts of things that us homeowners have to think about. But I know you've got some fire and smoke tips, and I'm all ears. What do we need to know this year to be more fire safe?
Well, one thing that's really important to know is that smoke alarm standards, these are the standards by which smoke alarms are built, they're being updated to improve fire safety. And the reason is because modern homes burn faster and hotter than older homes. So you need more warning. And First Alert has developed a technology called precision detection alarms, and they deliver key benefits. They are designed to deliver that earlier warning than you had in the past in the event of a home fire. And secondly, they're designed to reduce nuisance alarms. And the reason that's important is not because they're annoying and they're a nuisance, but it's actually the number one reason that people disable smoke alarms, which is really not a smart thing to do. Now, they have some other nice features as well. And one that I think is definitely worth talking about is that it has a 10-year sealed battery. So where we're so used to, you know, replacing our batteries when we change the clocks and all that sort of thing, now these detectors work for 10 years. And after 10 years, you simply throw them away and get another one. So this way, you don't have to worry about those batteries running out all the time and having to go shop for new ones.
I like that. Some good tips here. Tom, where can our listeners go for more information and learn more about this?
Yeah, if you head on over to moneypit.com, we've got articles on all of our products right there on the homepage. And you can also subscribe to the Money Pit podcast at moneypit.com/podcast.
If we go to moneypit.com/podcast, we can hear your weekly radio show there?
You can. That's right. You can subscribe for free. There's no cost. We deliver two new episodes a week.
I like that. Well, sounds great. Well, once again, I appreciate that. And this is Tom Kreitler of, let me get the name right in my brain. We talked about so many things. The Money Pit radio program at moneypit.com.
You got it.
Everybody's going to remember that now for sure. Tom, thank you so much for hopping on the show. I truly appreciate it.
Tony, anytime. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
And would you check out my Elite Entrepreneur interviews on Apple Podcasts? There's a lot of great insights about, well, anything you can think of to help grow your business and learn from the success of others who've been through their hard knocks and came out as champions. Go to Apple Podcasts and type in Tony, D-U-R-S-O, and play what appeals to you. And now back to the chat with Ben Gutman on how to design winning messages. All right, well, let's get into your vision path here, Mr. Goodman. We're entrepreneurs and business owners to help us learn. So let's start here. I'm going to flip through your book. And, you know, the first thing I see is you talk about, well, why go simple? And then you kind of talk about, what do our brains do in this busy world that we're in? So let's kind of take that. What do our brains do, Ben?
So the first half of the book is explaining the why, and the second half explaining the how, right? I joke on the very first page that this is a 208-page book about how to say things simple. It seems like I didn't take my own advice, right? And I also say, if that's enough, if it's enough to hear, keep it simple, then that's it. Don't buy the book. Don't go read it.
It's a one-sentence book.
Yeah, there you go. But what is interesting as I was digging into this was that the why is surprisingly deep and complex, and the how is surprisingly difficult. And you can get very kind of in the weeds on both of them. And that's what I tried to do through both sections of this book. And so you're talking about the first bit there is I break this up into kind of the challenge, the solution, and the like indictment of our enemy for this. So the challenge here is I call it our stupid brains in our busy world, right? We are very well adapted to a very different environment than what we are in today, right? We grew up as a species 250,000 years ago or so. And this was a world where a lot of things wanted to eat us. We had to pay attention to, you know, to certain types of stimuli and not so much other ones. And, you know, that's not the same brain that we need to thrive in this world, where there's a lot more things that are kind of buzzing and beeping, but also a lot less things that want to eat us at the same time. So there's a number of challenges in terms of, you know, how do we notice things? What things do we notice, right? What things do we remember? And then ultimately, what things do we internalize and take action on? And there's all sorts of limitations to this, right? We don't really even notice most of the things that are happening, right? By some estimates, it's like, I think it was like 12 billion or trillion. I'm going to get the number wrong, but a very, very large number of bits of information that kind of cross our senses at any given time. And we only attend to a fraction of a fraction of a fraction, like 0.0004%, somewhere in that infinitely long, you know, tail of decimals that we actually attend to that information. And we've known this for a long time, right? If you ask William James, the pioneering psychologist, about this, says like our attention is what we attend to, right? Like our life is what we attend to, is what we pay attention to. You know, everything else kind of passes by anyways. So most things pass us by. If we look at this in a modern context, we can look at the idea of like banner blindness, right? So this is an example of if you open up any web page, especially today as things have gotten really bad on the web of tons of ads, it's just bombarded, right? You see a auto-playing video somewhere, you see a banner, you see some like quick links in the middle, all the things, this big box of random stuff on the bottom. We don't even see those things. So if you actually look at the eye tracking studies that different designers and usability researchers will do, they'll show that our eyes basically skip right over those things. We've learned very quickly, because it's only been, you know, a handful of years really since we've began, you know, seeing this type of level of internet advertising, we saw very quickly that we just kind of get used to it. We realize it's not important to us and we don't click it. And we go on our merry way. We don't even see it. We scroll down past it.
We get numb. We train ourselves not to, because we literally cannot get everything done with the amount of messages that are vying for our attention. It's literally impossible.
It's impossible. The first banner ad ever produced was by AT&T in, I think it was 1994. And actually, it's tied to a very interesting campaign, which I encourage you to go Google. It's called I'm forgetting it. I think it's called the You Did or You Just Did campaign. I forgot what it was. Look up AT&T, like early advertisement stuff. Or You Will. That's what it was. It was called You Will. They predicted a lot of stuff about the internet and a lot of stuff about technology, but they got a bunch of key details about it wrong. But this was a banner ad tied into it. And it just so happened that it was the first one ever. It ended up getting like 40% clicks, like a click-through rate on that, which is impossible today. You couldn't imagine. That is like 10,000 times higher than the
click-through rate.
Maybe, well, you said it was at the beginning. Maybe it was the only post out there. Just kidding.
Exactly. Well, you know what it is that that'll tie into something we'll talk about a little bit later about saliency, which is we pay attention to the things that are different. And that was something different. And so therefore it worked. Now, when we're bombarded by them, it doesn't work as much.
Okay. So then therefore we now have what you call in your book, the case for simplicity, because well, we kind of didn't mention, I mean, when you mentioned all the messages that are out there, I started thinking of my inbox and all the messages, and I just started imploding instead of exploding because there's just so many, yet people have important things to say. So there's a lot of messages, people have important things to say, and now you're saying, I believe you're setting the stage to get their attention. You got to go simple.
Exactly. And so when you look at that busy environment, when you look at the limited kind of mental capacity we're able to bring to all this different stimuli, the only thing that really works is when something is simple. And so what do I mean by simple? Simple, I define as a message that is easily perceived, understood, and acted upon. And this all correlates with this idea of fluency. And so we know the word fluent, right? You can be fluent in English or Spanish or Mandarin or fluent in chess or cheese or whatever it is that you're interested in. It's flowing. Is actually, that's the Latin root for the word fluent. And that's kind of what it feels like, right? You know, you give something that's fluent, doesn't take any work. But if you ask a cognitive scientist about the word fluency, they're going to say that describes how easy is it for you to take something from out in the world, stick it in your head, and make sense of it. If it takes a lot of work, if it's really kind of like a, you know, it's hard to see something, hard to read something. I don't understand the words that are there. I'm not sure where this one's for me. If it takes all these like mental cycles, what happens is we don't like it. We don't want to buy it. We don't trust it. All the things that we don't want to do, the states that we don't want to get to when it comes to marketing, when it comes to sales, when it comes to advocacy, all those things happen when things are not fluent. But when things are fluent, well, you know, we like something, we trust something, and we buy something, the things we want. There's a huge body of research that points to the benefits of fluency across a whole host of different attributes. And that's what we mean by simple, is that it is something that is fluent, something that is easy to get in your head, to make sense of, and to take action on it. So that is ultimately what we're trying to get to when we are, you know, looking for effective messaging. As receivers, that's what we want, right? And as senders, and so I break out everything into the receivers and the senders, right? We all have different hats all the time. But just look at the equation pretty simply. Advertisers, salespeople, advocates, faith leaders, parents, coaches, whatever. We're all senders. The receivers are everybody else, right? The customers, the buyers, the voters, the donors. Those are the receivers, and they want something fluent. We want something fluent. When we're a sender, we have a really hard time getting there. And that is ultimately the gap that we're trying to address when we're talking about designing for simplicity, because we're pulled in this other direction. We're pulled in the direction of complicated by internal forces and external forces. Internally, we have this additive bias. We have a desire to kind of seek more complex answers sometimes to things than we need to. And then we also externally are pulled in that direction because we need another line on the resume. The boss wants this thing on the PowerPoint deck. The newspaper needs something to write about. And so we have, you know, these two forces which pull us in this other direction. And the result is this kind of chasm in the middle, which is that we want things over here. Senders are only able to do things over here. And then everything else kind of gets lost in between.
And as you're mentioning this, I'm thinking about, as you touched on very briefly, things being complicated. And I started thinking about just driving down the freeway, seeing a banner. If there's a lot of words, I don't get that message as I'm going by. Not that I'm going by ultra fast, it's just, or driving down the street. If there's signs with lots of words, there's no way to read that all while you're driving and paying attention to traffic and, you know, other vehicles and so forth. So, and you have a chapter on this on the crime of complicated. And I think I'm going to let you, hopefully that leads into what that's all about. And you can tell us a little bit more.
So it's funny you mentioned the highway signs, because I use that very analogy to kind of end the book when we're talking about something being minimal. We talk about, you know, what the ultimate goal is. And if you look, the Federal Highway Administration has a guidebook about how to design highways, right? And how to design, you know, signage along them. Turns out they have basically like a 5-point, you know, checklist for how you, for effective signage on a highway. It should fulfill a need. It should command attention. It should convey a clear and simple meaning. It should command respect from road users. And it should give adequate time for a proper response. All things that we want in basically every other form of messaging, right? And so it's funny that, you know, when we look at the analogy of a highway, it's a cliche to say life moves fast, life's a highway. But in many ways, it is a pretty good analogy for how we are going through, you know, going through our lives and our business today.
You know, that's so interesting. I don't do a lot of highway driving in the big city anymore, though I used to in the Los Angeles area for a long time. And I don't know about now, so I'm out of touch, but there was a time not too long ago where electronic billboards came up and they're flashing their messages, and you're trying to read these things. And it was just impossible. Maybe you remember an icon if it's a famous, well-known icon. Otherwise, it was just like, I was they got to get these off the freeway. These are dangerous. It was forcing people to slow down and stop to read the flashing billboards. And I was like, oh no, these are accidents waiting to happen.
Yeah. You know, that's exactly true. Cause what happens is this, you know, it blends into everything else. So to answer your question from before though, about complicated, the crime of complicated, I think that there are three main kind of indictments against the accused here. So complicated is, number one, it's selfish. It prioritizes ourselves as the sender over the receiver. It's, if you look at the terms of use or the privacy policies of every different platform, very dense, very complicated language. It's often used to kind of hide the true intentions or to kind of muddle them up a little bit to get you to just kind of go along, click the button and move on with your life, right? So it's about getting your own way instead of making sure that there's actual kind of recognition and benefits on the side and the end of it. Number two is that it's cowardly, is that it allows us to hide behind this wall of words. It allows us to basically just kind of hold up a mirror to somebody instead of giving them a message. We just can put enough out there, backs to the wall, clients asking me a question. I could just filibuster long enough and they're going to feel like they got an answer, even if they didn't. And then the third bit of it is that it's dangerous. I mean, it can hurt us in business, it can hurt us in relationships, hurt us in terms of our physical safety. I mean, it's the number one cause of aviation accidents. It's the number one cause of healthcare accidents. It is cited in terms of people hating their jobs, cited in terms of people having divorces. By one estimate, bad writing, form of complication, can cost businesses $400 billion a year, right? It's a large number in terms of what we lose when we are complicated.
That's staggering. I'm just like dumbfounded by how horrible the effect is from just being so confusing that, you know, and as I mentioned in the intro, sometimes messages that aren't really the best, but they get through and people remember them because of the pure simplicity of it. So I get that. Totally a crime to be complicated. Now, this next one I did not yet read the chapter, but it caught my interest. And it's the hole, not the drill, and hole, H-O-L-E, like dive into a hole. The hole, not the drill?
So what you're getting into now is the second half of the book where we talk about what the how is, right? How do we design stuff? We understand now how they're important. We understand that they help us do all the things we want to do and that failing to do so can cost us. So how do we create a simple message? And I looked at this from my background as a designer and said, well, this is a design problem. How do we organize things? How can we identify some principles that we can act upon to get to the state of simplicity. And there's five of them. We'll go through each one of them. But the first one here is beneficial. And if you've ever worked in marketing or sales, you've heard the, you know, kind of marketing 101 piece, which is people buy benefits, they don't buy features, right? You sell benefit, you sell don't sell the thing, sell what the thing does for me. And that's, you know, easily forgotten, but it is the most important thing that you can remember when it comes to any sort of act of persuasion. We talk about the hole, not the drill. So that comes from a quote by Theodore Levitt, who is a Harvard professor in the 20th century. And he said, I tell this to my students, by the way, that I say, if you forget everything else you learned in this entire degree, in this entire course, remember this and you're going to be ahead of most people in business. It goes, people don't want a quarter inch drill. They want a quarter inch hole. Right?
I love that. How
right?
simple.
People don't want a quarter inch drill. They want a quarter inch hole. They don't want the thing. They want what the thing does for them. They want the solution to their problems. They want a hole in the wall. They want status. They want whatever it is that they're going to get to. And the way which we get there is really by just asking appropriately a simple question, which is, so what? So what about the drill? That gives you the hole, right? And you can ask this question several times over and you can get deeper and deeper. You can get from emotional, functional benefits to emotional to the need. And it's vital that we do this whenever we're doing any sort of marketing communication, persuasive communication, because it's very easy for us as senders to just talk about the features, because features exist in the world, right? You can see them, you can taste them, smell them, touch them. You can crack open your five senses and experience the features. The benefits are more diffused and more distant, and they're something that the other side of the equation often is experiencing, so you can be more removed from it. It's important that we get ourselves closer to that, that we connect to that to make any sort of persuasive argument.
Oh boy, I've just learned something good. When I tell people sell, I've just started flashing in my mind. I'm talking the drill. This drill does this and this drill does that. What about the hole? I absolutely love it. And that in itself is very simple. And that makes it for an easier, simpler sale, if there's such a thing. Okay. I really like that point. And everyone's got to read this to really get more of that. That's big. And now the next chapter here I wanted to mention is, what's this Frankenstein idea?
So this is about focus. That's the second design principle. And these, by the way, this is not a checklist or a step-by-step. It's five different kind of principles. The better you can activate on them, the better you're going to be. But the Frankenstein idea, this is something I see happen all of the time in, again, the classroom and the boardroom, right? I'll use the classroom example, because I just had the midterm for my class. In the midterm, I give the students a brand and I say, here's your marketing brief, which is kind of the assignment, and come with your agency. They have a group project, come together and give us a pitch. I'll bring in some other professionals. We'll give you some feedback. We'll play the role of the client and we'll announce who won. And I always give them this warning, and there's only so much you can really get through sometimes, but I give them this warning of saying, don't give me back a Frankenstein idea. And so a Frankenstein idea is what happens when that group gets together and somebody says, hey, I have this idea. We should use NFTs. Somebody says we should use drones. We should use AI. Whatever the buzzword is of the moment, they say, oh, here's the hashtag. Here's another hashtag. Let's get this influencer and let's get that one. And so all of a sudden you have a bunch of different things up on the whiteboard. And instead of somebody kind of circling one of them and saying, this is the one we're going with, they just take them, tie some string around them, put them into one presentation, and then throw it out there and see what kind of happens. This is reminiscent of Frankenstein's monster, which if you read Mary Shelley's original description of the monster, she says, well, this is not a just hideous creature. It is something individually, each component is selected for beauty, right? So she describes kind of pearly white eyes and lustrous black hair and big broad shoulders and all these other things. But when they're together, they form this hard contrast. It's worse than the sum of its parts because it's so many things that were just kind of shoved together. And that happens every time that a kind of leaderless or rudderless committee gets together to kind of produce ideas. Committees are the worst, but we can do this in our own heads too, right? It's much better to have one idea that you wholeheartedly embrace, one message that you wholeheartedly send, rather than trying to put a bunch of things together.
Not like a drill that grinds your coffee beans and makes espresso in the morning at the same time sort of thing?
Exactly. Well, the example that I'll use is a lot of businesses go around and they say, hey, we are the best value. We have the best customer service, and we are the most sustainable company in the market. All of those things sound great, but none of those really stuck with me. Because you're am I buying you because you're the cheapest? Am I buying you because you're the most sustainable? What am I getting out of this? If you look at somebody like Walmart, they sell everything under the sun, but they've been very focused on what they talk about. Every single marketing message they've ever had from a top line perspective is about value, right? It's about low prices. And that's been a huge driver of their long-term success over the decades.
Which is really, really a tough thing to do, because you always hear go niche or niche, always go small, and yet they've gone big yet, and they really have gone big. So it almost seems to be an oxymoron, but yet it really works. And I think it's exactly as you say, it's based on the message, the simplicity of the message. I think that is the subground to that going niche, going small. Because it's the message, again, as we talked about quite a bit here, it's the message that people see, that they put in their mind or their brain, that they act upon. So, and I think also part of the simplicity is, instead of taking all these things that work really, really well together, and we could spend the rest of this episode saying silly things, it doesn't necessarily make a good machine, a good device, a good anything, because it's got to be congruent to that industry or that use or that utility of it. So I get that. And I think this may go into, and yeah, this is not really a primer on the whole thing, but your chapters are so interesting. I just thought I would kind of pull some of that good information out. And I just really love this conversation. You talk about being salient and that constraints breed creativity. Where at first you think it's the opposite. And as soon as I read that, I was like, if you're constraining something, you're making it more creative. Okay, I'm going to let you kind of talk your way out of this one now.
So salience is the idea that something is rising to your attention, that something is noticeable, that it stands out, that there's contrast. We only notice things that are salient, right? That is kind of the definition of it in many ways. We only notice what's different. We only will pay attention to the figure versus the ground. So when we talk about how we get there, is my contention on this is that if you want to do something that's different than everybody else is doing, you have to play by different rules than everybody else is playing. And so there's lots of great examples of this, you know, from Dr. Seuss, from like Super Mario, from many different things, where the constraints of a word count or the amount of data on a disk or something like that pushes these creators to do things that are going to be a little bit different than they would if they had unlimited stuff, the unlimited ability, unlimited time, unlimited resources. And what's interesting about this is the data. So the data supports one piece that's really great, which is, the secret is medium pressure. So if you want to do something a little bit different, you don't want to give yourself too much pressure where there's no room to do anything, right? Let's say you have a deadline on something. I have to write a new article or client needs a proposal for tomorrow. Well, that's not enough time to really do a lot of interesting stuff. Not time to really get the juices flowing on something. So what do? You got to copy and paste, and you got to, you know, use templates or something like that, or ChatGPT nowadays. On the other end of it, if you say, hey, this project's due in a year, you say, that's not my problem. That's future Ben's problem, right? That's not for me. That's somebody else. And so what ends up is that amount of time, that amount of kind of rope there is just enough to kind of, you know, we hang ourselves with that amount of rope, right? When we get too much. The the secret is medium pressure. When you look at like time pressure, different studies about this, is that they look and they say, having a little bit of pressure and something that's kind of enough to push you out of the norm, but not enough to kind of suffocate you. That's what you're looking for. And then one last thing on this that I always like to share is we think of constraints as something that's a kind of upper bound limit. We say, oh, we only have 140 characters, right? Only this many megabytes. But constraint can also be a lower bound, which is interesting. So let's say you're putting you have to think of a new tagline for your product. Well, you know, instead of saying, well, let's make a list of 5 of them on the board or 10 of them, say we have to get to 100 of them before we can consider these, before we can start to whittle them down. So by putting that lower bound of a limit, what's going to happen is you're going to get through all the familiar territory, all the easy stuff. You're going to get through that a lot sooner. You're going to get through that in the first 10, the first 20, the first. And then when you get later on, you get into the weird stuff, right? You're at a point so far past what you normally would be doing that you start to end up in this uncharted territory, which is often the recipe for getting to something that's salient.
I've been thinking with this, and one thing I was thinking while you were mentioning this is emergencies, catastrophes, the pandemic. I've seen millionaires and zillionaires come out of that. And I'm thinking what you're saying, there's this constraint, there's this time pressure, there's this is the way it is now, and you got to deal with it. And those that are creative with it and figure out solutions really quickly, not next year, but now, they come out as the winner. And it's starting to give me some ideas. In fact, it just gave me a great idea on something for my podcast, but that's talking shop. That's not for this show. But you really gave me a very good idea. I can tell you later on that, because a constraint breeds creativity. I really do like that. There's a lot more to that. And again,
that's awesome.
It makes successful people. Now this next chapter, I don't want to be condescending or silly too much, but you talk about welcoming the enlightened idiot.
So this is a chapter about empathy, right? It sounds like that's not a very empathetic thing to say. But if you look at the origins of the word idiot, you know, it's the common man, right? I'm an idiot. You know, we're all idiots in the things that we're not experts in, right? And enlightened means somebody that knows something that you don't. So this is actually a term of endearment. We're all enlightened idiots all the time in the areas that are not our expertise. Empathy in this context means, are we talking in the language that our audience understands? Are we meeting them where they are in terms of their motivations, their emotions, their needs? And of course, how they want to be communicated with. It's very easy for us to get stuck in our different bubbles in life. And there's this whole, you know, kind of science behind this called the false consensus effect. Just kind of a quick, you know, explanation of that. Let's say, you know, my favorite ice cream flavor is mint chip. And I think that, well, you know, I'm a pretty normal guy. Therefore, everybody else probably likes mint chip also. Right? If I had to estimate the population, probably 70% of people like mint chip, maybe 20% like chocolate, maybe 10% vanilla, maybe some other weirdos out there, something else. But in reality, that's almost certainly wrong. Right, is that most people probably like chocolate, some people like vanilla, and some people might like mint chip, but I am prone to, again, the false consensus effect, which is where I overestimate how much I represent the norm for the whole population. We all do this. We do this in business and ice cream, and we do it in politics, we do it everywhere else. It's that I think I'm pretty normal, all the people I know I think are pretty normal, therefore this is what it's going to be. And that leads us down a lot of dangerous paths. When it comes to communicating in terms of getting our message heard and understood, we are more likely to use jargon and buzzwords and acronyms and all these different things that may be kind of points of failure for our message, that instead of communicating it in the language of our receiver. The solution to this is like the most no-duh thing in the whole book, but it's also the thing that most people are going to totally ignore, which is you got to test your message. You got to get out there and you got to talk to people and you got to say, hey, does this make sense? Does this work on you? You can go out and do a big focus group and a survey. I know people that run marketing research firms and make lots of money doing those things. But if you just call, if you say, hey, I'm doing this, I'm selling this product. It's for accountants. You know what? Call up five accountants and just be like, hey, you know, can I just pick your brain for something? And that alone is not a scientific, you know, scientific study or anything, but it will give you enough insight to kind of get out of your bubble and make sure that you're speaking in the language that your audience needs to be met in.
That is so true. And I think so important. I remember way back in the day when I started in various entrepreneurial projects, I had the good sense from being trained in corporate America to survey and check with people. And I would find that, you know, if I gave a design idea of three different things and I would think something's a winner, it would always surprise me what my peers or people surveyed would pick. You know, sometimes, you know, the preponderance, the majority would pick something that I wouldn't have picked. And we kind of have to realize that while we come up with the idea, we come up with the business or the project as an entrepreneur, business person, and so forth, we may think we may know better, but we may in the terms of the product itself or the service, but in the message and the communication, we may not. And that's where we really need to survey our customer to find out what they think about it, because it's people like them that are going to buy it. And I think that is something that's missing in a lot of entrepreneurial projects, is surveying and checking people. And I think it's because we tend to think we know better because we created or developed the product. But that is so important. I really like that. And yes, on the ice cream. All right. We got maybe time for one more question here. We've covered some really important things. Let's just say this next one to be politically correct and PG rated. How do we take this all together now, Ben, and just be simple, say the minimal, you know, instead of this is the best, greatest thing ever that you need. You know, by the time you said that, the person has gone past your window and hasn't read it. So how do we say the minimum, get that attention, to then give us a chance to talk about our product and service?
Absolutely. So we're talking about the last one of the five principles here, which is minimal. And so I use, you know, the word BS as part of the description, the vivid description for that. When we're talking about minimal in terms of messaging, and I lied a little bit before when I said this is not a checklist or step-by-step, but minimal is at the end for a reason, because it's about having everything you need, but only what you need. And when we're talking about this, that means this is not about the fewest number of words or sentences or paragraphs or pages or slides. It's about the least amount of friction. And so if you look at how a user experience designer views the world, they view it in the lens of friction, right? You want to put friction in between the things that you don't want people to do, and you want to remove friction from the things that you want people to do. And so you look at like a shopping cart, like a checkout flow on an e-commerce site. If you ever bought something online, well, it's really easy to do it, right? You know, you get really quickly into that shopping cart. It removes all the distractions for you, and it makes it, you know, painless to enter your zip code and get everything to pop up on there. But if you ever try to unsubscribe from something, let's say you try to quit a gym, right? They make it really hard. Right, they make it so you have to go in, you have to show ID, you have to do this, you have to get something notarized, you have to give up your firstborn child, all these things to prevent you from doing the thing that they don't want you to do, which is to quit the gym. So when we talk about minimal in messaging, it's about removing the words or the formatting even that makes us kind of like have a little bump in the road, because every one of those little bump in the roads is an opportunity for us to pull off. Talk about the highway, the metaphorical off ramps from our messaging. We're trying to get people from point A to point B, from not understanding to understanding, from not buying to buying. Every time we're making it harder for them to do that, we're pushing them off and saying, hey, you know what? Go pay attention to one of the thousands of other things that you could be paying attention to.
Once again, this is Ben Gutman, and we talked about Designing Winning Messages. His book is called Simply Put. You can find it, I'm sure, where books are sold. And you can also go to his website, bengutman.com, B benguttmann.com. And a special thank you for those that listened to the end. I just really love how Ben took his vision to reality. I've learned a few things on how to be simple, simple, simple. You know, I've mentioned this in my intro. We talked about it here throughout this interview, how important it is to have a simple message and how to make that message simple and how to make it so that it's most effective and how to get the person's attention. But you got to read the book. There's a lot more information in it. Now, the successful winners of this world, they know this material, and now you can learn all about it too. And you know, when you scroll through social media and again, see billboards or you're driving by, you'll recognize now how the more clear and simple messages stand out and get your attention. And social media, just try it, you know, just scroll around and all these words and all these things and all this moving stuff, does it grab your attention or do you move on? Do your own survey on that. And lastly, if you like the show, do us all a favor, please share this with a few friends to help them too, okay? Let's use this and let's help you move on your journey to success. Ben, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. And to our audience here, I want to say, just take action. Success awaits those who persevere and remain steadfast despite the odds. Sow good seeds, do good deeds, and join me on the next episode.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's edition of the Tony D'Urso Show with Tony D'Urso. Be sure to tune in again next Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Now, go enjoy the weekend.